I'm very happy now to welcome filmmakers Jillian Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson. Their new film is called Still Dreaming, and it screens this Thursday, February 21st at 7 o'clock at the performance space at La Tienda in El Dorado. It's part of the Real New Mexico film series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's great to have you back on the show, and I find it sort of interesting that this is the second film about people in an institution doing Shakespeare. The first one was Shakespeare Behind Bars. This is Shakespeare done by residents of a nursing home for former artists and performers in New Jersey. How did you come to make this?
Well, I guess, usual with our films, it's from a sense of curiosity. And, you know, I was intrigued by the idea of seniors doing Shakespeare, and I figured it would be best if they were seniors who had done some Shakespeare or had done some acting at some point in their lives, so they weren't starting from zero. So I researched and found a home in L.A., and I found a home in New Jersey just outside of Manhattan, and approached them both, and it turns out that the one in New Jersey had a Shakespeare group already, a group of seniors who rehearsed scenes, did staged readings. And so I approached the home, and it's known as the Actors' Home, and it's in Inglewood, New Jersey. And it is a home for anyone in the entertainment industry, but primarily its residents are actors, singers, and dancers. And because it's right next to New York, most of these were actors and singers and dancers on Broadway. And I approached the home, and I asked them about the possibility of them, following their Shakespeare group. And in discussions with the home, it became apparent that they wanted to maybe take a step up with their program there and challenge the seniors in a bigger way and maybe put on a staged production of a play and involve professional directors. So they, along with the home, we did a national search for directors and came up with a couple of gentlemen from New York who are young. Which for me and for both of us was an interesting dynamic to have that intergenerational aspect to the piece. They decided they wanted to do Midsummer Night's Dream. The directors were hired, and then we showed up with our cameras. So,
and these two guys were not seasoned because they're pretty young, but they were experienced Shakespeare directors.
Yes.
Yeah, and they've had sort of a meteoric rise in New York City in the theater world. They're kind of, just emerging as important directors and actors. And we don't get into their story too much in the film, but they are becoming really well known in New York City as kind of one of the hot new things. So,
yeah, when I was watching it and thinking, who are these guys? And it'll be interesting to follow them and see what they do. But it's so... I mean, the film is poignant in so many ways because as you watch these people, you can see both by the way they're speaking and acting and singing and moving that they are experienced on stage. And there are also some photographs and things where you see what they looked like and their legs in the air and what they used to do. And here they are in various stages of mental and physical health and loss. And it's at moments even painful.
Yeah, I think it was very difficult to be there, but also very inspiring. I mean, to us, what we saw was people who'd sort of been, you get put away in your nursing home, right? You are no longer capable of taking care of yourself fully, or your family can't handle it. And so you've been put in this home, and it's a very nice home, very comfortable, very well staffed, and very top quality, yet there's not much to do. And what we saw was these people re-engaging in their passions. And so within the sort of container of the sadness that can come from old age, what I really experienced was an inspiration of these people taking the leap again and having courage to step back in. And of course, there was a lot of obstacles that they faced and a lot of challenges, a lot of surprises for them. But the fact that they would be willing to reengage in their passion and their creativity, I thought was really amazing. And I hope I'm still doing that when I'm 90,
Well, that also goes back to your original question. It was one of the inspirations for the film is what is it like to be creative in your 60s, 70s, and 80s. Because Jelena and I have been making films together for over 20 years. We started together in college, and now we're in our mid-40s, and we're starting, you know, the kids growing up, and we're starting to look towards the future. And, you know, we always want to be making films, but, you know, what sort of capacity will we have when we get older? And what is it like to be creative when you're older? How does it change your life? Is it possible? And, you know...
Is it important?
And is it important, right?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of questions about what the various stages of life are for, and in adolescence, you know, and as a baby, you're learning what the world looks and feels like, and as a adolescent, you're sort of working with your identity, and as an adult, you're trying to do things and make the world a better place and raise a family, and if you're called to that, and all that's, and then in old age, in theory, there's kind of wisdom and giving back what you know and kind of keeping the younger generations from going bananas or doing stupid things, but really old age, it's almost like it's just a time to rest.
And you know, that's interesting because that comes up in the film several times where the residents say, I came here to rest. I'm retired. You know, this is just bringing up too much stuff for me that's uncomfortable. Yet they showed up every day. Sometimes they, you know, some days they'd be like, I can't, I got to take a nap, you know. But in general, it was that sort of seesaw back and forth for them of reengaging in something that they were, that was their livelihood, as well as being like, you know what, I did this, and I just came here to put my feet up, you know.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, the staff would report that everybody was getting up early and getting to breakfast, and that they were getting dressed early, and that wanted to, you know, the people in the wheelchairs were asking, can you take us up now to the rehearsal room? And, you know, whereas before they're really not so much on a schedule, not much
right.
to, you know, and the staff was really happy about that. It seemed to get people up and awake. And
yeah, I mean, you could see in the film that it energized them. And it was interesting, the relationship with the staff, because one of the things that I find so irritating, and if I live to be old and somebody does this to me, I don't know what crimes I'm going to commit, but a lot of people infantilize the elderly. Right. So they say, it's time to take your dippity, as if they were 2 years old. You shouldn't even do that to a 2-year-old. And you could see in this home that they couldn't really quite get away with that because the people who were residents there were so accomplished and intelligent.
Right, yeah, and actually this isn't really in the film, but a lot of staff would tell us, you know, we just love these residents. We love to sit around and listen to their stories. And one thing I really noticed was how respectful the staff was of these residents and how much they enjoyed hearing about their past on Broadway.
Well, you'd walk into the home in the morning and, you know, the receptionist would be singing a duet from the Sound of Music with one of the older residents. I mean, it's just...
Wow.
Yeah.
So it probably attracts staff that are into the arts and music.
Well, that's another thing. One of our main characters, Charlotte Fairchild, she was a very well-known Broadway singer-dancer. She was in 42nd Street and MAME and Damn Yankees. And she has an aide who's with her every day who loves theater and dancing. And she's thrilled that she gets brought into this whole play process. And she actually gets a part in the play as a fairy. And so that was really fun to see. And she encourages Charlotte to sing songs with her and run lines. And
yeah, we should mention that the play that they do is A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Right.
Right.
Which is hilarious. Because, I mean, when you think, okay, what 85-year-old is going to be able to play Puck? And that, I guess, casting itself was a big process.
Right, and the directors didn't know the first thing about these people, really. They had a little one sheet of background on each person, but getting to know where their abilities are at right now and their mental capacities and stuff was a whole different thing. So they had to spend a week or two just reading the play through with everyone and kind of seeing what everybody was capable of, and then they were able to cast. And there's this funny line where they say, you know, the directors are talking about the casting, and they say, you know, what's funny is it seems like we would have given the same parts to the same people 50 or 60 years ago.
I know. That was so interesting. Yeah. I mean, people have their personality and their ability at the age of 25 or 85. Exactly.
And Charlotte Fairchild, the one that Jillian was talking about, ends up getting cast as Puck.
Right.
Because she's so mischievous and, you know, sort of gives a performance of Puck like it's completely original every time.
Because her memory's gone.
Because her memory's gone. She has Alzheimer's. And, you know, there's something about when you act, you try to be in the moment. Well, she's entirely in the moment and full of surprises. But very puckish, if you will.
Right.
Yeah.
We're talking about the film Still Dreaming with filmmakers Jillian Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson. So were there medical benefits to these folks for doing this play?
Oh, yeah. It was interesting to talk to the staff right after the play wrapped up because they said that they couldn't say who because of privacy reasons, but they said many of the residents who were in the play got their psychotropic medicines reduced and their other medicines reduced. So that was a significant thing to them because, you know, a lot of these people are on really strong drugs. And another thing was they felt that the whole atmosphere of the home had shifted, that everybody felt that this was an important activity and there was a sort of more buoyant attitude throughout the home and an excitement that something interesting was happening that was bringing people together. So even, you know, there was only 13 residents in the play. There's 120 something in the home, and what was cool is that it seemed to affect many, many people there, not just the ones in the play.
So did you follow up? I mean, did the residents continue doing Shakespeare afterwards? I guess they'd already had some kind of Shakespeare group when you came in.
Yeah, they did, and they've kind of drawn it back again to what it was before, with basically a reading group and a scene group, a theater group, which is what they had before. They have not tried to redo something of this scale, but they, you know, they're interested in doing it again, and they're in talks with local universities to possibly come in and help, you know, with students on an internship basis.
For directing, yeah, new plays.
Oh, very interesting. Now, what did the two of you get out of doing this film?
Well, I have really personal reasons for doing this film. My grandmother, who was just about my best friend when I was a little kid, was put into a nursing home, and it was just so heart-wrenching to me to go visit her and just see her kind of just vegging away. And I just always felt there was an injustice into that and that it wasn't right and that she should still be engaged even if she had had a stroke and she couldn't talk. And it just seemed like sitting around in her bed wasn't enough of a life, you know. She still had a lot of physical health. So to me, this was important to me to see, like, what are the other possibilities for aging and for institutions? And I think there's a huge potential for growth and change and more positive lifestyle and quality of life in our nursing home institutions, in our assisted living, you know. So that was sort of a very core reason why I wanted to do this film and the question I had. And so I got a lot out of it in that way.
I was also inspired by actually my father, who died about 5 years ago and was one of the inspirations for, you know, the curiosity about what it's going to be like growing old and being creative. Because, you know, when a parent dies, you look at your own mortality. And it's similar to Jillian's journey about what is the how can you be engaged as a senior? You know, there's all the cliches out there about, you know, just keep going for life, you know, take every day and rise to the challenge of it. And no matter your age, no matter what your obstacles are. But it's true. I mean, if you can, because either you're living life or you're not.
I think the point there, too, is that you need support as you get older. You need to support to keep engaging. Maybe you're not as capable as you were before, but that doesn't mean you're not worthy of anything. You know, so that we as a community, as younger generations, I think it's one thing that would enrich our lives is to support our seniors more in you know, various activities. And there's a great organization that we're teaming up with for outreach. It's called Engage, and it's run by a guy named Tim Carpenter. And he's reimagining the whole senior home convention into artist colonies. So they're retirement communities, but first and foremost, they're artist colonies. And he's using the college or university model where he brings in very talented and experienced teachers in all of the arts to engage the elders. And so he'll be using our film. We'll be teaming up with him to hopefully get, you know, this idea and this vision out more broadly.
Well, there was one fellow in the film who was, well, I don't want to give too much of the film away, but he was a very vital person and has almost a kind of explosive moment in the film, but he's a real artist and he collects stuff, and it seemed like visual art and collage and things like that were such a wonderfully expressive medium for people of that age because it didn't require heavy lifting and memorization and stuff like that.
Yeah, and actually, this didn't end up in the film, but Charlotte Fairchild, who we were talking about before, who has Alzheimer's, her stepdaughter was telling us that she'll do art with Charlotte. And, you know, if she's visiting and Charlotte will remember the next day something about the art project they were doing, which is completely out of the normal. You know, she usually doesn't remember anything from the previous day.
Right.
And in the play, we saw that too, where she'd have moments of recall from the play process. And you know, they were intermittent, but it was really interesting to see those brain waves firing, you know, those synapses firing and connections being made for her that might not otherwise.
Right. Now, the two of you were there making this film in the, what was it called, the Actors' Home?
It's the Actors' Home, yeah. It's part of the Actors' Fund, which is a national organization for actors.
Were you supposed to kind of be invisible, so to speak, while this was being shot, or did you get to know them and they you? I mean, were you really part of this whole process?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of being a documentary filmmaker is both being the fly on the wall, but also engaging with your characters in the film and, you know, gaining a sort of a relationship and a sense of trust between the two of you. You know, you have to keep this observational approach to everything, but at the same time, when the camera turns off, we socialize, we sit and talk, you know, because it's not all about when the camera's on. It's also about the relationship that you have with your characters. You know, I mean, it's hard sometimes not to engage in the midst of filming because you can see how things are going, because you're sort of able to stand back and get a wider picture of the room or the situation. But the people are, you know, in a heated argument, or they are, you know, not seeing what's going on in another, you know, the train wreck that's happening over to their left because they're looking to their right. And, you know, it's an interesting duality, but it's a part of that, of documentary storytelling, is being, you know, walking that line between engagement and observation.
And we were there every day for 6 weeks, so they really got used to us. They loved seeing us. You know, it was really fun. We had a really nice experience, I think, being a part of their lives for that amount of time.
I have to say it also, I mean, all of us who were maybe kind of heading toward middle age or well into middle age, whatever middle age is these days, really...
We're not there yet.
No, not quite. we really have to think about this, because this is us in a generation, and I think there are so many of us who really would like to be in a multi-generational environment and not just be around other old people. And what could that be like in a way that is healthy for everybody, and the young people aren't just going to be burdened by us?
Exactly. Yeah, it's very much on our minds as we're making this. And, you know, one thing we plan to do is try to set up intergenerational screenings for this film. You know, bring a local theater or a college group to a senior center to watch the film together and have a discussion after. You know, try to make it an actual thing that can facilitate intergenerational discussion, and maybe hopefully alliances come out of that. And we're going to be, I think, working. There's a really wonderful group called the National Center for Creative Aging, and they're also sort of coming out with some toolkits and blueprints for how artists in the community can engage with elderly.
The film is called Still Dreaming by filmmakers Jolan Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson, and it screens this Thursday, February 21st at 7 o'clock at the Performance Space at La Tienda in El Dorado, and that's a presentation of Real New Mexico, which has an ongoing film series.
Once a month. Yep.
Once a month.
RealNewMexico.org, is that...
I'm not sure what their website is, but they are. It's usually the second Thursday of the month. There's an evening screening, and it's for New Mexico-based filmmakers. And I should say that this film that we're screening on Thursday is an almost finished film. It's not quite finished. So what we're doing with this screening is it's our last opportunity to get some audience feedback before we lock picture and go on to all the finishing steps. So for us, it's a really great opportunity to kind of see how things are landing with people and for people themselves to get involved in our creative process if they're interested.
Exactly. Speaking of creativity, the audience can put in their two cents.
Exactly.
And maybe this will be a nice intergenerational audience also.
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you very much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm delighted now to welcome to the show eminent musicians Dave Anderson and Bert Dalton. Dave, they're laughing.
You got us on
at
that
the
one.
Eminent. But they are. Dave Anderson is a woodwind player, and he's a teacher. He's a KSFR DJ from time to time. Bert Dalton is a piano player and music director of the National Dance Institute. And they are doing a wonderful event that's coming up this Sunday, February 24th at 4 o'clock. It's called Time Out for Brubeck, a tribute to the music of the Dave Brubeck Quartet at the Scottish Rite Masonic Center, featuring the two of you and a bunch of other musicians as well. Welcome, gentlemen, eminent gentlemen, to the Radio
Thank
Cafe.
Thank you so very
Thank
much,
Mary Charlotte. Thank you.
So Dave Brubeck lived a long and beautiful and productive life. He died last December at the age of 92 minus one day.
Isn't that incredible? And so well loved, so well liked. He's one of those jazz musicians that, I mean, we just say everybody digs Brubeck.
Yeah.
I mean, for many, many years, his group, the Time Out recording they released in 1959, was the first jazz recording to sell a million copies.
Yeah.
The State Department sent his group to foreign countries to make friends for the United States. They were diplomats for the State Department. They just had such an incredible run. This quartet was together from 1951 to 1967. They released over 50 recordings, and it's just classic stuff. But not only that, this is relevant music. It's cool music. Everybody knows about Take Five. A lot of people know about Blue Rondo. But just the depth of the music the quartet played, most of the compositions were Brubeck's. Desmond contributed some gems, including Take Five. It was just so different and something that everyone was attracted to. They were jazz stars.
One of the things that I love about that whole State Department ambassador piece is that they learned when they were traveling to all these different countries different time signatures that affected
exactly.
the music we know and love.
Exactly. These guys were musical sponges. Wherever they went, they would absorb from the culture that they were in and incorporate it. I remember 150 years ago when I was in college, I think the first Brubeck album I had was called Bravo Brubeck, which was when they were on tour in Mexico in 1967. And they took Mexican folk songs and played them with the quartet. They added a percussionist, and it was just wonderful. I mean, it was true to the source of the music, but done in a very interpretive jazz way. Blue Rondo a la Turk, his famous composition, is based on a Turkish dance rhythm. And we're gonna talk about this at the concert, too. I call it Brubeck Decoded, because we really want to excite the audience and involve them in you know what these guys were doing. It's more than just playing wacky time signatures. There's a reason for it, and there's a real beauty in the mathematics too of the rhythms.
And you can decode that for us?
Well, we're going to talk about it. Let's put it this way. We're going to tell the audience how we're counting, and hopefully they'll can count along with us.
Right. I know. I used to go listen, when I lived in Boston, I used to go listen to Balkan music, and and under the table I was like clapping and trying to figure out where the one was when it came back around.
And you know, it's funny, in other cultures that's just such, it's just, they grow up with it, they dance with it, they feel those rhythms. And you know, I saw an interview that Brubeck did early on, and he said, you know, we've jazz has come a long way, he said, since its inception, harmonically and melodically. I mean, this was around the time of Charlie Parker, so there were all sorts of melodic explorations, and Bill Evans was playing some really cool chords on the piano that we hadn't heard before. But everything was still in 4-4 and occasionally 3-4. And Dave Brubeck was a real why not guy. You know, let's try this. And the success of this quartet was not only did they play in weird time signatures to our ears, but they made it swing. They made it feel natural. Those guys were dancing and playing within those time signatures and just made it. They made it sound easy, and Dave and I have discovered that it's not that easy.
No, but you know that within the Dave Brubeck Quartet, there was an element of fun when the guys were playing. And they made it sound, as Bert said, very playful. And I think the audience gets into that as well when they hear the music, because the tunes are recognizable. There are things, they're just fun to listen to. And probably fun to watch being played with some of these odd time signatures.
Right, and one can't help but feel like, I mean, I didn't know him, but Dave Brubeck must have just been a marvelous human being to be around, too.
You know, I wish I would have known this guy as a friend the more I learn about him. He met his wife in college on a date. Dave's mother made him go to a dance. He didn't want to go to a dance, but he said, all right, Mom, I'll go. And he asked his friends, he said, well, if I have to go to the dance, I want to talk to the smartest girl there. And they introduced him to Iola. They didn't dance. They sat and they talked for 3 hours. And at the end of the 3 hours, they decided they would get married. And they had a marriage that lasted 70 years.
Good heavens.
Yeah. Is that incredible?
That's the way to do it. Go for the brains.
Yeah. Go for the brains. They had 6 sons, most of whom are musicians in their own right, Chris and Darius and Dave Jr.
And Matt.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. And in fact, they performed with Dave later on. He raised his family. He and Desmond were complete opposites. After the gig...
Now, tell us who Desmond is.
Okay, Paul Desmond, who was the saxophone player, who Dave Anderson is playing his parts in our quartet, and quite eminently, I might add.
Thank you.
but your eminences.
It was funny. These two guys kind of lived vicariously through each other. Dave would, after the gig, he would go straight home to his family and... you know, do his work. I mean, he just all he wanted to do was raise his family, do his work. Desmond, on the other hand, had a taste for the scotch, and he was a heavy smoker and an eye for the ladies. And it was funny how the two of them got together, being such different personalities. But then one of Brubeck's talents was taking disparate elements and putting them together in a way that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So you've got 4 completely different individuals in the quartet. I mean, you've got fire, water, air, and earth coming together to create this music in a really remarkable way.
And so the Dave Brubeck Quartet was like the quartet that you're going to play the tribute this coming Sunday,
exactly.
Piano, drums, bass, and saxophone.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's what we're going to feature. I mean, Brubeck, he had a marvelous career. We're just focusing on one period. I mean, he wrote... he was a very religious and spiritual man. He wrote a lot of religious music. He wrote orchestral works for choir. Paul Desmond went on, I remember his incredible CTI recordings from the 60s and 70s with Don Sebesky arranging as a solo voice. So they all had musical careers beyond the quartet.
But it's interesting, you know, Paul Desmond always had a real... sense of loyalty to Dave Brubeck. So when he would go and perform or record aside from the quartet, he would use a guitar player, which was most often Jim Hall.
Oh, that's so interesting. And he wouldn't, nobody else may play the piano if it's not Dave Brubeck.
I don't think I've ever, and I've heard a lot of Paul Desmond, I don't think I've ever heard another piano player behind him. It's usually the guitarist, Jim Hall. Or maybe somebody playing some synthesizers.
Right.
You know, for background.
You know,
sound.
That's true. I never thought of that. I'm glad you brought that up.
Would you like to play a Dave Brubeck tune?
Very much so.
Are you allowed to say tune?
Sure.
That's what
track?
I say all the time.
All right.
They're tunes.
What are you going to play?
Absolutely. Well, we're going to inflict a little Dave Brubeck music here in the radio
in
cafe.
In the Santa Fe Baking Company. We love it.
We're going to do a little version of one of his compositions called It's a Raggy Waltz. And the title comes from the fact that it's somewhere between ragtime and a waltz. It's essentially in 3/4, but he goes through little episodes at the beginning of the melody where it sounds like it's in 2 for a little while, and then it goes into 3. And it really sort of illustrates the very playful rhythmic games that the quartet was doing. So anyway, here's half of our quartet. And,
okay. Anderson and Bert Dalton playing music of Dave Brubeck, the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Now, when you play music by these people who have had to have been your superheroes since the time you were young musicians, how do you do it? Do you try to imitate? Do you make it your own?
I think we have to make it our own because you know, as jazz musicians, you have to be an individual. You have to express yourself. We're not trying to do record copies of these tunes. In fact, when you listen to the Brubeck Quartet playing this music, each time it's completely different. There's all sorts of experimenting and taking chances and discovery going on. And, you know, we talked about this a lot when we approached this music, and our consensus was we're going to pay homage to the compositions, to the arrangements, to the spirit of it, but the only way we can pull this off is to be ourselves and to be playful and interplay within the four of us. We're honoring those who have gone before us, but this is here and now. But the other thing is, this music is best heard live.
Yeah, that's so true.
You know, because we don't know what's going to happen on Sunday. You know, there's going to be...
that's exactly right.
There's going to be some high-stakes rhythmic games going on there, so we don't know exactly what it's going to be like. And that's what jazz is all about. It's very much an in-the-moment kind of music. So we're not trying to create a dusty museum piece here. We're playing music that is relevant today and music that should be heard. Everybody knows, you know, Take Five and Blue Rondo, but... You know, these other tunes are really well worth hearing live and exploring and getting inside to really appreciate, you know, the genius of these artists.
Let's talk for a moment about the life of Dave Brubeck. I mean, he was the son of a cattle rancher in California.
Absolutely.
And he didn't read music for the longest time, if ever. I don't know if he had ever learned to read music.
I'm not clear if he did later on, but we do know that he wanted to go into veterinary medicine. Music was just a lark for him because he was, you know, he admired his father and he loved the ranch. He loved roping and riding. So he was going to be a veterinarian, but his veterinary teacher said, you know, you're spending way too much time over in the music department. Why don't you just go over there and major in music? Which he did.
A very wise teacher.
It was good advice for Dave Brubeck. Right before... he was ready to graduate, it came to the attention of the dean of the college that he could not read music, and we believe this was a learning disability, probably dyslexia, which is, curiously enough, is the main charitable work of the Scottish Rite. You know, we're doing this work at the temple. So the dean called him in and said, okay, we've made a decision. We will let you graduate from college on one condition, that you never teach piano because we do not want you to embarrass the college.
And he said, all right.
He said, okay.
I'll be a famous musician.
Well, that wasn't what he had in mind. Actually, it was 1942, and he did what most other young men of his age were doing, which was, you know, enlisting in the conflict that we were in. He joined an army band in the Bay Area, which was actually where he and Paul Desmond met. But Brubeck's unit was sent to Europe. He was serving under General Patton, and his unit was one day... from being sent into the Battle of the Bulge.
Good heavens.
When a USO show came through, and this sounds like a Hollywood story, they needed a piano player, and they said, hey, can anybody come up here and play this show? And Dave raised his hand, and he so impressed the colonel that the colonel held him back and said, okay, your job is to put together an army band. So Dave put together the first integrated band in the army. It was called the Wolfpack.
Of course, my goodness.
This is in 1944 at this point, so that obviously ruffled a few feathers, but that was how he was. You know, Dave didn't see any differences. He just saw musicians, and he said, this is what my band is going to be.
And also, he knew where jazz came from.
He did, absolutely. After the war, he went back to college, was studying under Darius Milhaud, who is a famous French composer. There's an interesting story. He had exactly two lessons with the great 20th century composer Arnold Schoenberg. The first lesson, Schoenberg went over some materials with him. They talked, and Schoenberg gave him an assignment to write something and bring it back. Brubeck brought it back to the second lesson, sat down at the piano, and began to play. And at the end of the first measure, Schoenberg stopped him. He said, wait a minute. He said, why did you choose that second note? And Brubeck said, because it sounded right. And Schoenberg said, well, that's not reason enough. And Brubeck challenged him. He says, and what makes you the authority on what note sounds right? So obviously their teacher-student relationship didn't last any longer than that session.
Ah.
But you have...
To the great benefit of the rest of us.
You have to admire a guy who will stand up to an authority and say, no, I made this decision for a reason. I'm going to stand by it.
Very interesting. Now, Dave Anderson, tell us about your experience. I mean, you're a saxophone player, you're a woodwind player, of hearing Dave Brubeck when you were young.
Yeah, you know, I was, this dates me, but I started hearing Dave Brubeck and Paul Desmond, who caught my ear when I was in high school. And, you know, one of the things I think that all musicians do is as we're coming up, we find somebody that we really like and admire, especially sound-wise, and you use that as a model. And when you're just learning, you need some kind of a model to follow, so you know what you want to sound like. And then, as Bert said later on, you know, your own personality comes into it. You start to do things your own way, but still, in the back of your mind, that sound is there. And so,
I think you've really incorporated that sound just in your own natural style of playing so well. I mean, you can hear that Desmond influence in there, that beautiful tone and yeah. his sense of melodic.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I've played this way all my life, and so this is.
Not
finally,
yet.
Finally, the op. I mean,
as George Herring would say, well, not yet.
Thank you for that too. Yeah, it's fine. It's great to have this opportunity to finally get to perform some of this music in the style that I would most like to play.
Yeah, the upcoming concert, for those of you who are just tuning in, is called Time Out for Brubeck. It's on Sunday at 4 o'clock at the Scottish Rite Masonic Center here in Santa Fe, and it's a tribute to the music of the Dave Brubeck Quartet. And I want to make sure we have time before we go for another song. Are you going to, do you have anything else you want to play?
We do, and I just want to mention real quickly before we play again that this is a fundraiser for the Scottish Rite Masonic Center. We have such a gorgeous auditorium over there. This building is a century old. It was completed in 1912. We just had our centennial celebration. It's very much tied into the history of Santa Fe and New Mexico. It is really a community treasure. For many years, you know, the Masons are pretty good with secrets, so there was a long time there where, you know, guests weren't coming into the building. But in recent years, we've really opened it up. We've had performances of Santa Fe Opera, Santa Fe Concert Association, New Mexico School for the Arts, National Dance Institute, New Mexico Children's Foundation.
Et cetera.
I got a whole long list here, which I'll cut short. And the Scottish Rite has really made this facility available for the community as actually an arts center. But now we need some help. It takes a lot of money just to keep the doors open over there. The next 100 years are not as certain for the Scottish Rite as the last 100. So we have events like this to bring people in to enjoy this facility, to raise funds, to keep the doors open so we can continue doing this work.
Excellent. Good. Well, that's very good to know, and it's such a wonderful space, and it's such a cool building.
It is.
That
it's just beautiful.
Kind of pinkish-orange, salmon-colored
right.
building.
The sound is so good.
Yeah.
For us as performers and for the audience. It's just a great, great space.
Well, what are you going to play now?
We're going to do, this is actually one of Paul Desmond's compositions called 11-4, which alludes to the time signature. And just to help the listeners out a little bit, we're counting this a group of three, a group of two, and then two groups of three. So we're counting 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. So
it's a waltz with one beat missing.
Yeah, that's right.
A waltz
yes.
by a guy with a stone in his shoe, I think. But what's cool about it, and check out how flowing the melody is, and it couldn't be in any other time signature than 11. Anyway, Dave does a great job on this. We hope you enjoy it.
And once again, Burt Dalton and Dave Anderson playing music of the Dave Brubeck Quartet. And the tribute is this Sunday, the 24th of February at 4 o'clock at the Scottish Rite Masonic Center. Now, we haven't talked about the other musicians who are going to be there. Milo Jaramillo on bass and John Bartlett on drums. Wonderful musicians whom we've seen play around here for years.
Our trio has played together for about 10 years, so it's good having a tight rhythm section. We can lean on these guys.
Right.
I would just like to mention that tickets are, it's by general admission at the door. For a modest donation, and if folks are interested in doing a little more, it's greatly appreciated. We do have a special VIP package, which is preferred seating. There's a reception following, and if you're interested in that, please call 982-4414 to reserve your VIP spot.
Well, it's wonderful having both of your eminences on the air, Burt Dalton and Dave Anderson. Terrific musicians, and we're so looking forward to this event on Sunday.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Mary
Charlotte. Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
We appreciate this opportunity.
And let's go out with a little more Dave Brubeck.